she was at that give up point. So I said, okay, I'll try. Worst I could do is find out that I couldn't locate him also.
A family brings home the remains of a Territorial Guard member 6 decades after his death. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 20th of August. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a delegation visits Barrow to hear about changing Arctic conditions.
They didn't call it climate change, but they observed how the ice was further from the shore in the fall, thinner in the spring than it had been in the past.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance has a simple request. If you smoke, take it outside. Smoking hurts more than just you. Secondhand smoke increases the risk of coronary heart disease and kills nearly 50,000 non-smoking Americans every year. Smoking around your kids causes chronic and life-threatening diseases and is linked to sudden infant death syndrome. If you choose to smoke, make a choice that protects others who don't. Take it outside. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Control Alliance.
A family in Nebusquiak, near Bethel, is celebrating the return of Nick Stephen. His remains will be put to rest this weekend, decades after he was lost to them as a soldier in the Alaska Territorial Guard in World War II. From member station KYUK in Bethel, Angela Denning Barnes has the story.
It took 6 years to really research and find his remains.
Sophie Jenkins is Nick Stephen's niece.
I don't know, the feeling is just anticipation and mixed with, you know, wanting to welcome and then put a closure to what we have been waiting for so long.
Stephen's remains were found in a cemetery in Walla Walla, Washington, where he had been sent for tuberculosis treatment. But Jenkins says there was a lot of confusion about what had happened to him and how he got there. What the family did know was that Stephens was a healthy 24-year-old when he went into the Alaska Territorial Guard in 1942. Jenkins said her father, who is Nick's brother, didn't know much more than that.
With the limited English, my father and my grandfather wouldn't understand.
Jenkins says there were documents about her uncle's whereabouts, but there was a language barrier. Her father speaks Yupik, but the military correspondence was in English. She remembers when she was 9 years old, her father gave her an envelope with some papers on her uncle.
He had mentioned that his brother might be on Alaska or Dutch Harbor, might be buried there. And so, you know, it was kind of confusing for me.
Jenkins didn't know it at the time, but the envelope had clues as to her uncle's whereabouts. Not until 2007, when the envelope resurfaced when her parents moved, did Jenkins get the chance to start searching again. She hit a few dead ends at first.
She went through a lot of other different people, agencies. She was at that give up point, so I said, okay, I'll try. Worst I could do is find out that I couldn't locate him also.
Irene Washington is a rural veterans liaison, a new position in Bethel. She was able to call around and find that Stephen fell ill shortly after he joined the ATG when he was fighting in the Aleutian War. He was sent to Washington for treatment.
And we found him. It was a very nice day when we found him.
Back then, many Alaska Natives were getting TB, but people didn't know how serious it was. There were an estimated 2,000 to 2,500 active TB cases among Alaska Natives, but treatment was limited.
At that point in time, there was no drug therapy for tuberculosis.
Dr. Beth Funk is a medical epidemiologist for the state. She says the treatment then included just resting at home or spending a year or more resting in a hospital or possibly getting surgery.
People might have traveled to Mount Edgecombe or Anchorage or to Seattle for pretty invasive surgeries of collapsing the lung. There were a number of ways to try to do that to control TB, and that was really all anybody had in the 1940s to treat TB.
It's unclear just what treatment Nick Stephen received. It is known that he got sick shortly after going into the Guard in 1942, and he passed away 2 years later. Stephen's family is Russian Orthodox, and they are holding a wake today, followed by funeral services Saturday afternoon in Nebusquiak. In Bethel, I'm Angela Denning Barnes.
As the nation's only Arctic state, Alaska is bound to play a key role in the country's future commercial and industrial activities. Senator Mark Begich traveled to Barrow this week to hear from local residents and invited guests about their perspectives on proposed energy development amid a rapidly changing environment. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Low ceilings and patchy fog in Barrow Thursday contributed to a slow start for the field hearing as planes touched down a bit late, but the meeting of federal and North Slope borough officials went without a hitch. Senator Mark Begich chaired the U.S. Senate Commerce, Science, and Transportation Committee field hearing.
There's no question in my mind the importance of the Arctic. As I talked to my colleagues and explained the value in what is here and what's potential, with or without us participating, as the Arctic continues to melt and the industrial or activity occurs up in the Arctic, it is important for us now to take a lead in doing what we can to manage it.
The panel members met at Barrow's Inupiat Heritage Center, surrounded by historical photos of the region's whaling culture. But that culture is facing 21st century challenges, vying with national energy needs and the inevitable uncertainties about the safety of offshore oil drilling posed by this year's calamity a world away in the Gulf of Mexico. North Slope Borough Mayor Edward Itta made a plea for researchers to include traditional knowledge in any assessment of the region's potential.
Some of our elders were aware of the current environmental shift decades ago, long before it became a national concern. They didn't call it climate change, but they observed how the ice was further from the shore in the fall, thinner in the spring than it had been in the past. And ice cellars, where we store our food, were increasingly subject to the melting of the permafrost.
He said even the elders didn't realize how quickly things would change. Itta called for a federal commitment to Arctic research and emphasized the dangers of offshore drilling to the region's culture. Ice seems to be the unifying factor among Arctic pursuits, whether they be subsistence hunting or oil exploration. U.S. Coast Guard Rear Admiral Christopher Colvin told the panel that rapidly melting ice is opening up the Arctic, and that could mean opening up a can of worms.
We don't know what the Arctic will look like by mid-century.
Colvin said the U.S. does not have a strong presence in the Arctic, and if the nation wants to preserve sovereignty there, there is vast room for improvement. He said the Coast Guard is observing increased human activity in the Arctic. Cruise ships now ply the Northwest Passage, and merchant ships, some carrying thousands of tons of gas condensate, transit above Russia to Asia via the Bering Strait.
It is important to remember that there is only one way in and out of the Arctic for over half the world, and that's the Bering Strait. The Bering Strait may become the Gibraltar of the future. Why does the Arctic matter to the United States? Because the highest potential concentrations of oil and gas in the Arctic coincidentally lie directly above Alaska.
Colvin stated that the U.S. needs to do more research on oil spill response in the Arctic. He said the Coast Guard's two sea ice breakers, the Polar Sea and the Polar Star, are inoperative at present. He said it would cost $68 million to repair the Polar Star alone, and a new sea ice breaker could cost $500 million. Colvin said the Coast Guard is strapped to keep its resources in the Arctic operable, yet without those resources, no rescue would be possible for a ship sinking or for an oil spill response in the frozen regions of the north. Alaska Oil and Gas Association Executive Director Marilyn Crockett added that Alaska oil supplies about 12% of the nation's supply. She said that one-third of the nation's offshore oil resources are offshore, the state of Alaska. She said the oil industry has spent millions on research in recent times.
Can't emphasize enough of evaluating the research that's been conducted already, identifying the data gaps that are out there, and prioritizing the limited resources that all of us have. The industry has privately funded hundreds of millions of dollars in research studies, and more than $150 million has been invested just in recent times on new environmental and wildlife-related studies.
NOAA's Arctic Vision and Strategy has been created to investigate new opportunities and to ensure that decisions related to management, development, and use are based on sound science. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
The Department of Justice has decided not to pursue charges against former VECO Chairman Bill Allen in a child sexual abuse investigation. Anchorage Police Lieutenant Dave Parker confirmed today that federal authorities have declined to prosecute. Allen is serving time in a federal prison after pleading guilty to bribing Alaska lawmakers. His conduct with at least two underage girls had been the subject of a police investigation since 2008. That inquiry developed more urgency in spring 2009 when a prosecutor with the Justice Department's Child Exploitation and Obscenity Section joined local detectives in the case. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, the primary battles heat up for the U.S. Senate.
Our country's in crisis. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. It's an economic crisis. It's also a crisis of leadership in D.C.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
August 24th is primary election day. Polls are open 7 a.m. until 8 p.m. To find your polling place, go to www.elections.alaska.gov. And when you go vote, bring identification. If your name is not on the register, you may vote a question ballot. If you need language or other assistance while voting, you may ask the election board or bring a person of your choice to assist you. This message sponsored by the Division of Elections.
Last night, Republican candidates for U.S. Senate, incumbent Lisa Murkowski and challenger Joe Miller, squared off over issues for the first time. Miller asked Murkowski if she'd ever voted for a bill or resolution that was unconstitutional. When Murkowski answered no, Miller brought up the stem cell bill as something the Constitution does not back.
If also in your rebuttal, you can tell Alaskans where have you found in Senate Bill 5, voted on April 11, 2007, where the U.S. Constitution permits federal funding for human embryonic destruction and laboratory research?
Murkowski countered that there were many things the Constitution doesn't spell out.
In our Constitution, it specifically provides for funding for a Navy and an Army. But it does not specify Air Force. Are we to suggest that perhaps we should not be funding our Air Force because it's not included in the Constitution?
Joe Miller said the constitutional framers intended to limit central government and wanted a federalist system that gives power to the states. Senator Lisa Murkowski is the only woman on the U.S. Senate's Republican leadership team, and after only 8 years in office, is Alaska's senior senator. But her challenger, Joe Miller, says she's just not conservative enough. Miller has the backing of the national California-based group, the Tea Party Express, which says it's poured $400,000 into his campaign. Miller calls himself a constitutional conservative and wants to shut down the Department of Education and phase out Social Security and Medicare.
Our country's in crisis. I mean, that's really what it boils down to. It's an economic crisis. It's also a crisis of leadership in D.C.
He's also against earmarks.
This concept that we have of senators and representatives being elected to bring back the poor is the reason that we're at the point we're at. Nobody has the leadership because they believe that their role is to bring back maximum revenue to constituents.
But Senator Murkowski says earmarks make up less than 1% of the federal budget and that criticizing them can be a red herring.
We do need to be more aggressive in reducing spending. Absolutely. That's where we start. But once that budget has been defined, once we have agreed that this is what the budget will look like, I'm going to work as hard as I possibly can to ensure that Alaska gets its fair share of those federal dollars.
Murkowski defends her conservative credentials by saying she wants to reduce the debt, revamp the health care overhaul, and protect gun rights. In the past year, she's fought the Obama administration's plan to regulate pollution from power plants and factories and voted against the confirmation of Supreme Court Justice Elena Kagan. She rebukes Miller's accusation that she's veered to the right because of his challenge. But Murkowski says even as she stands with Republicans, she thinks that to be successful in Washington, you have to work with others, like she did on a bipartisan energy bill last year.
Compromise is not necessarily a bad word, a negative word. It means that you take some of the good ideas that you have to offer and some of the good ideas that I have to offer, and we try to build something that works for the whole country.
Three candidates are vying to win the Democratic primary this year for the U.S. Senate. Sitka Mayor Scott McAdams has the most organized campaign. He says his local government experience would serve Alaskans well.
I think that having a small-town mayor in Washington, D.C. would better reflect the values of our state.
McAdams says at the local government level, things get done. But that's not how he sees things working in Congress.
The stock and trade of politics in Washington, D.C. is that you join a caucus organization, and if you become leadership in that caucus, which Senator Murkowski has become, you spend your time working to shame, blame, scapegoat, and grandstand on issues pointed directly at the opposite party.
McAdams is anticipating a win in Tuesday's primary. He's already planning his campaign to defeat either Joe Miller or incumbent Senator Lisa Murkowski in the general election. He says he's raised about $25,000 for that effort, a fraction of the funds Murkowski has on hand. Frank Vondesar is challenging McAdams in the Democratic primary. He says he would like to rein in corruption in Washington and make other big changes.
Reverse the deterioration in our democracy after 28 years of Bush-Reagan fascism reinforce the gains that we've made so far as the health care reform and trying to restructure the economy and undo the damage done by 28 years of Bush-Reagan fascism.
Vondesar lives in Homer and describes himself as a lawyer, engineer, and part-time thrift store worker. He's lived in Alaska for more than 20 years. Vondesar has been a candidate for U.S. Senate several times and has also run for the U.S. House. When asked why he keeps running, he says, "Hope springs eternal." A third primary candidate, Jacob Seth Kern, is on the ballot but did not respond to interview requests in time for this story. Voters will weigh in on Tuesday in the primary for the U.S. Senate race.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. If you're looking to start or grow your own business, Alaska SourceLink can help. They're a web-based referral center for Alaskans seeking business assistance with more than 100 resource partners across the state. For more information or to access resources online, go to www.aksourcelink.com. Connecting businesses to the help they need when they need it. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska Center for Economic Development.
Fairbanks could soon face tougher fine particulate pollution regulations. The Environmental Protection Agency is reviewing its standards for the tiny particles called PM2.5 produced by combustion. Fairbanks began regularly violating the standard during the winter when cold air traps emissions at ground level after the EPA substantially tightened it in 2005 due to increased concerns about health impacts. Borough Transportation Director Glenn Miller says permissible levels could be ratcheted down again by the end of this year.
And they're not only looking at the 24-hour average, but also the annual standard. If that were to occur, obviously it's going to make it more difficult for us to meet attainment for PM2.5.
As a federally designated non-attainment area for fine particulates, Fairbanks is required to work with the state to develop a plan to get into compliance. The plan, due in December 2012, has to include an inventory of emission sources, environmental models, and pollution control measures. Miller says investigations into several potential sources, including local power plants, continues, but wood burning for heating is the current focus.
The studies that we've been conducting last winter and that we'll conduct this winter will help us better understand the contribution from things like coal and from automobiles and from sulfur from home heating systems. And until we have that information, we really can't arrive at control measures around those sources unless we know the exact contribution. Right now, we do know that wood smoke is a significant contributor, and therefore that's why we focused on that.
In June, the Borough Assembly approved a wood stove and boiler removal and replacement program. It offers participants cash payments and tax breaks to fix, get rid of, or swap out old units for newer, cleaner-burning, EPA-approved models. Miller says there's already been a good response to the grant-funded program.
We have a total of $1 million that is available for this program, and we already have about 20% of the money already spoken for through applicants that have come in and expressed interest and filled out applications.
Miller says 82 people have applied, most wanting to replace old stoves. A wood stove industry trade group reports that similar programs in lower 48 cities with fine particulate pollution problems are able to halve emissions through elimination of older stoves. He says local surveys indicate that there are about 3,000 such units in Fairbanks that need to be removed or replaced at a cost of $7 to $8 million. If the current pilot program is successful, it could leverage additional state and federal grants to continue it. Miller stresses that a public education campaign on how to operate stoves cleanly and the importance of burning dry wood is also important. The Republican candidates for governor in next week's primary election have focused on the future of the oil and gas industry as the defining subject for voters to consider. And while other subjects have begun to draw attention, there is little difference in what they are presenting on most of those issues. APRN's Dave Donaldson reports.
Governor Sean Parnell, who's running to be elected to his own full term in the state's top job, is defending his stay-the-course approach to the gas line, urging voters to let the current process continue before trying to upset the open season that's currently underway from the two possible competing projects. However, the more vocal of his opponents are not letting go of the subject. Bill Walker's in the race to gather support for a line to Valdez and the shipment of gas to world markets. He says Parnell is only giving lip service to consideration of that as a way of getting a natural gas line from the North Slope.
Stop studying, stop waiting for somebody else. Let's go to work, put our people to work, get the job done. We need to have someone with my background, my passion, and I'm a fighter, and I will fight, and I'll fight, and I'll fight for the future of this state, and I will not take no for an answer as we have for so long.
And Ralph Samuels says the Parnell administration needs to be giving more thought to increasing oil production by reducing taxes that are too high. He says that while the state budget continues to grow, production of the oil that pays for that budget declines by 5% a year.
We are in an unsustainable situation. Nobody likes to talk about this. As governor, I can make you one promise. We will get back on a pro-business tack, and we will get investment in this state, private sector investment.
All three candidates have other issues to talk about, and they see those issues without much argument among them. For example, they'd reject federal money if there are unacceptable requirements for its use, or they would all wait until the permitting process is complete before taking a stand for or against the Pebble Mine. Although Samuels and Walker are leaning toward protecting the fish and the fishing communities. The big difference is that Parnell is using a different verb tense in talking about those issues. While the others talk about what they will do or would do, he points to things he is doing or has done, like the merit-based scholarship program, the fight against domestic violence, and turning down the chance to apply for federal education money.
It really is about action, not words. It's about growing our economy and strengthening our families. I am the only candidate here tonight who is actually doing those things. When it comes to growing the economy, creating an investment climate here by reducing taxes, by creating tax incentives, by putting deferred maintenance money on the streets, by working to build roads to resources.
A total of six candidates are in the Republican primary. Besides those mentioned are Sam Little, Marika Hlotko, and Gerald Hikas. Voters in the Republican primary will make their decisions next Tuesday. I'm Dave Donaldson in Juneau.
State officials today reversed course and said it hasn't found any egg sold in Alaska linked to the Wright County egg national recall. The State Department of Environmental Conservation said on Thursday, associating Olympia Valley eggs with the Wright County egg recall was incorrect. That was based on information given by a retailer. State health officials on Thursday confirmed at least two cases of salmonella matching the strain tied to recalled eggs. State tests show some North Pole garden plants watered from sulfalane-tainted wells contain the industrial solvent. State Division of Public Health environmental toxicologist Lori Verbrugge says initial tests on early harvest produce show the leafy parts of plants are more susceptible.
The leaf samples that we looked at, lettuce leaf and also one sample of rhubarb leaf, did contain measurable amounts of sulfalane. But when we looked at other types of vegetables, like the fruit or the root of different vegetables, cucumber, radish, zucchini, we did not see any sulfalane in those parts of the plant.
Verbrugge says that while rhubarb leaves contain sulfalane, the stems, the part people eat, did not.
So this really confirms what we thought we might see based on what is in the scientific literature, and that is that sulfalane is taken up by plants and it just travels passively through the plant and it is left behind in the leaf when water evaporates off of the leaf surface. The sulfalane is left behind. So it looks like, at least from this preliminary information, leaf lettuce might have detectable sulfalane, but other types of vegetables that aren't the leaf might be okay.
Verbrugge says the levels of sulfalane detected in the leaf samples were measurable but below a level of health concern. She says the determination is based on toxicity levels determined for sulfalane in drinking water.
Very conservative calculations with the same risk-based number for sulfalane, but just taking into account the fact that people drink more water than they eat vegetables.
Verbrugge says tests indicate that sulfalane does not accumulate in the body, but adds that it's possible that the solvent, like some other chemicals, could trigger effects that do not manifest until years later. She says repeated exposure to sulfalane over the long term could also cause health problems. The state plans additional sulfalane surveillance tests on mid and late season produce, as well as a longer-term controlled greenhouse study. Flint Hills Refinery is paying for the research. Wells in an area of North Pole are contaminated from historic sulfalane spills at the refinery. Flint Hills has been providing alternate supplies of drinking water to affected residents since the well issue was discovered last year. And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. Last night's Senate debates are also on our website. We had reports tonight from Angela Denning Barnes in Bethel, Ellen Lockyer in Barrow, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Annie Fite reported from Anchorage, Libby Casey from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station. The Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association was created by the legislature to provide coverage for Alaskans who are denied health insurance due to a high-risk medical condition. For example, a person who has diabetes and has been rejected by an insurance company will be accepted by ACHIA. Ask an insurance broker about ACHIA. Information is also available at www.achia.com. This message sponsored by the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The Federal Housing Administration's network of FHA-approved housing counseling agencies offers free expert advice to homeowners whose mortgages are at risk, underwater, or in need of refinancing. Visit hud.gov/Alaska for a counselor near you. This message sponsored by HUD.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.